From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a prologue to his book about the effects of sonar and acoustic ocean noise on marine mammals, the science writer Joshua Horowitz says maybe the war was inevitable. Two of the most successful hunters on the planet, whales and humans, were probably destined to collide at some point. And that's what happened on March 15th of 2000. As Horowitz explains it, the paths of the most powerful navy and an elusive species of whale converged. 17 whales stranded themselves on the beaches of the Bahamas island chain, which started a series of events that read more like a mystery than an exploration of ocean science. The book happens to be both, and today in the program, Horowitz is joining us to talk about it. It's called War of the Whales, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there's an irony at the heart of Joshua Horowitz's book about the conflict between the American Navy and marine mammals like whales. It was the Navy that really first started paying attention to whales, started studying their behavior and their remarkable capacity to use this pulse of sonar to hunt and to communicate. And using that knowledge, the Navy developed its own powerful sonar system. Horowitz tells the story of a number of characters in his book, two in particular who make a connection between this sonar technology and a rash of mass strandings of whales. He calls it a struggle between two of the most successful hunters on the planet. It's called War of the Whales. And Joshua Horowitz is joining us today to talk about it. You can join us too. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joshua Horowitz is a science writer and is joining us today from the NPR member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. And Joshua Horowitz, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I guess I want to begin with... So I really like the prologue. It's really short, but it gives you a sense of, I guess in some way, the stakes of this story. The sort of, you mentioned this kind of grand evolutionary picture for whales after, the, you know, mass extinction of the dinosaurs, the ancestors of the whales. You know, they return to the ocean at this really successful reverse migration. And then millions of years later, of course, we show up. So I guess in some way, War of the Whales, that's not a tongue-in-cheek idea, that the whole idea of conflict and war, that's an important part of the story, I guess.
Well, you know, humans have been in conflict with large mammals for all of our existence. I mean, we've certainly hunted lots of them to extinction, and including whales, and we've had a very conflicted relationship with whales since primitive times. They've always had a certain mystique and power over us, partially because of their size and also just because of their character and how they are. But we've also always hunted them, going back tens of thousands of years. So we have this conflicted competition, really, I think, on some level with them. And this is about the competition between whales, who were, again, mostly after the commercial whaling time, when there were very few left, mm-hmm. relative to how many there used to be, and the Navy, which really wanted to dominate the oceans, including acoustically.
When did you come upon this idea? When did you decide to start writing about this?
Well, I first heard about this story. I read a newspaper article with the headline, Whales v. Navy, and it sounded almost like a divorce proceeding, which in some strange ways it is. It was about this court case that had been working its way through the courts. Eventually it gets to the Supreme Court, which is the story I narrate in the book. But at the time, it was working its way through the lower courts, and I was sort of intrigued by the idea that there was an environmental attorney at Natural Resources Defense Council in Los Angeles who was suing the Navy, and not so much on behalf of the whales, because the whales don't have standing, but it was sort of framed as this national security versus environmental protection sort of battle. And as I got deeper into the history, as I started to dig a little bit into the Navy's own history with marine mammals, and the research they've done going back to the very beginnings of the Cold War, I saw that there was, in fact, a great untold story here, which is, of course, what every book writer is always searching for. Yeah. So that was it.
I'll defer to what you want us to talk about and what we shouldn't talk about, because the book is something of a mystery, and I'll let you preserve that. Let's start with the one character, of the two major characters anyway, Ken Balcom. Tell us a little bit about him. He's interesting because, on one hand, of course, he is, not that these two are necessarily have to be in conflict, but he's a scientist, but he's also a military man. And that's kind of the essence of the conflict for him. Talk about Ken Balcom. Comes from a broken, kind of dysfunctional family.
Right.
I guess he falls in love with the sea.
Yeah, he's an interesting character because he cuts against the stereotypes. I mean, the attorney, Joel Reynolds, is not a stereotype, but he's a classic environmental activist, lawyer, dyed-in-the-wool activist. Ken Balcom is really a reluctant activist, and he came through it through a love of science and eventually a love of whales. He grew up by the sea, picking. He was a beachcomber as a kid and as a teenager all his life, and he because really collecting whale bones on the beach is the way scientists initially had studied whales, and he was from an early age particularly interested in beaked whales, which are very rarely seen. They're not rare, but they're rarely seen because they have evolved to spend so much of their time underwater diving. They only surface once every hour, more or less. And so the only evidence of them is when one dies and their bones wash ashore. And so he had an early interest in that. And then he became increasingly interested in whales and started working on in whaling stations, picking through the guts and bones and organs of, you know, castaway parts from in Richmond, California, which is the outside of San Francisco, which is the last whaling station in America. And then eventually he started doing whale research in both the Northwest, Pacific Northwest with orcas, and during the winters down in the Bahamas with these deep diving beaked whales.
Of course, he gets drafted, applies to be a Navy pilot, hates it at first, learns to really love it, graduates first in his class. What kind of perspective about whales' lives, because he comes to devote his life to studying them, as you say, but what kind of perspective does he get about whales from the Navy? Because that's where he really comes to, I get a sense of this understanding about the kind of this sound surveillance and the sound sonar systems of whales.
Right. Well, this is one of the ironies of the story, and this story really is rife with them. But one of them is that, you know, he was the one person. We're talking about Ken Balcom, who was the scientist who was at Ground Zero the day the whales came ashore in the Bahamas in 2000. And he's probably the only person anywhere who would have had the combination of expertises to know, number one, how atypical it was for this species to strand, to understand that this may well be an acoustic event, an acoustic trauma that they were suffering, and who to call at the Navy to get them involved in helping to investigate it. And he worked in as a sonar operator back during the Cold War, all the way back in the late 60s, early 70s. And this is the days of passive sonar, where we had this elaborate, at the time, highly classified listening system. We had basically wiretapped the world's oceans so they could keep tabs on Soviet submarines just by listening. And while he was running these stations out in Midway in the middle of the Pacific, was the one he ended up running, which was the forward listening station. They had the best listening devices in the world for underwater sound. And while they were listening for submarines, you hear everything that's happening underwater. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is what the Navy refers to as biologicals, which is any fish, marine mammal, or anything alive that's making noise in the ocean. And there are a lot of them. And so part of his job was to differentiate Soviet submarines from baleen whales that make low-frequency noises. And so he learned a lot about acoustics and about the way whales communicate and behave underwater, as did other Soviet, other Navy scientists using similar technology.
It's interesting. I want to just spend a little bit more time with this question of the history, I guess. There's another good character, Bill Watkins, comes to this, starts to do research about the sounds that they're hearing. William, is it Cheville?
Yeah, Bill Cheville.
Bill Cheville, another character there. Tell us about them, because they go about really decoding the sounds, as you mentioned, they're starting to hear.
Right. Well, they're two of my favorite characters because they really are the nexus of the Navy and the science community, which is really what so much of the story is about. And this is the post-war period when the Navy had just recently figured out, by the way, that whales echolocate underwater in much the same way that bats echolocate in the air, using sound to bounce off of objects and to both to navigate and to hunt. And as soon as the Navy figured this out, they became very interested in, as you mentioned in the introduction, reverse engineering that biosonar to improve their own technology. So Bill Cheville was one of the early acousticians who the Navy used to first prove that dolphins and other cetaceans use biosonar to navigate and hunt. And then when they started listening in through these listening stations, which were built in the 60s and 50s, as early as 53 was the first one, but they heard so much noise down there, they needed to separate out the biological sounds from the military sounds. And so they, in order to do this, they had to figure out what these other sounds were. So they sent Bill Cheville and Watkins, who was Watkins was kind of the engineer, and Cheville was a zoologist. There were no whale scientists at the time.
Right.
And they were sent out. They went out in small boats, and they would see it. They would sight an animal or hear an animal. They would have a microphone in the water over the side, a hydrophone, and they would either see or hear an animal, and then they would record it, and then they would find the animal and capture it.
Yeah.
And kill it,
yeah,
and then send the bones back to Cheville, who was the curator of the Boston Zoological, the Harvard Zoological Museum, and they would send the bones back there and compare it to what they had on file there and say, what is this? And then they would radio back and say, that's a minke whale. And then so they would write down minke whale, and they'd have the sound of what the minke whale is. So what, by the time Balcom, and this was going on, they did this for decades. They went around the world on small boats doing this, not continuously, but for decades. They traveled the world doing it and had this amazing album that was classified for a long time.
A huge database, right? I mean, like 70 different marine mammal species that they had collected?
Yeah, they really got it. They got almost all of it. Not all the marine mammal species had been identified at the time, but they certainly got the sound print for them. And by the time Balcom in the late 60s was working in these sonar listening stations underground with headphones on, this was part of his Bible to, you know, this is part of his resource to say, okay, that's this. And it wasn't, and there were fish too, but they were focused on marine mammals, but there are fish that make sounds, but he had a whole catalog there. And it's a fascinating piece of the story.
Yeah. Well, so it starts to converge, of course, in March 15th, as a matter of fact, 2000. Go through this part of it, of the story for us, if you would.
Okay.
Ken Balcom and others are working with the Earthwatch Institute, and they get word that one whale had been beached, and then another, and then another. Take us through that.
Okay, so to set it up, this is the deepest underwater canyon in the world, the Great Bahama Canyon, and it's four times the depth and breadth of the Grand Canyon in Arizona, so that gives you a sense of its scale. And these beaked whales had evolved in situ there. I mean, there are beaked whales in deep water environments all around the world, but here they had been in residence for, well, we don't know how long, but, you know, millions of years, tens of millions of years perhaps, and evolved to dive to, you know, a mile, even deeper down to feed on deep diving squid. And so deep dwelling squid. So in any case, he had been studying this resident population of beaked whales for about 10 years with his wife, Diane Claridge, who was his research partner. And they got assistance from Earthwatch, which would send volunteers down to help with the research because they were self-funded, essentially. He never got any of this Navy funding. He was too much of a maverick. So in any case, He also knew that these animals never strand alive. Some species of whales do commonly strand. Pilot whales, other species, it's not uncommon for them to strand alive. But beaked whales, never, or almost never. So that day, when they went out to begin their day's surveying out on the in the canyon surface, there had been a whale beached right on the beach outside of their research station, their home there on the beach. And then after spending half an hour getting it back out, pushing it back out from the shallows back out to the deep canyon where it belonged, they heard that there was another one stranded down the shore, and then another one and another one. And by the end of the day, there were 17 reported around the outlying islands. And they spent the day, he and the volunteers spent the day in shark-infested waters, and of course, a lot of these whales were bleeding from coral cuts and whatnot. They don't belong in these shallows. He had never seen. I mean, the remarkable thing is that Ken Balcom had been studying these animals all his life, in photographing them and videotaping them, and he had never been this close to a live beaked whale because they're so skittish and spend so much time at depth. But he was there, literally pushing them out to sea, and sometimes they'd turn around and swim back to shore because they were so freaked out about what had happened in the canyon, or were so disoriented. And but the next morning, you know, so he pushed them, as many as they could, out to sea, but he knew that some of those wouldn't survive and that there would be other whales would show up on other beaches, most likely. And so that's when he decided to call a former classmate of his from graduate school, who now ran the Office of Naval Research's Marine Mammal Division back in Washington, D.C., and told him, you know, we've got a mass stranding here of beaked whales. Are you guys, meaning the Navy, doing something down here? And can you get me some help to investigate this?
It's what happens when a whale beaches herself? Because you say that one thing Balcom understood was that most don't, in fact, survive. That too much had already gone wrong. Why is a whale beaching itself, and what's going on there?
Well, again, there are different reasons why whales strand, and it is a mystery. Anytime a whale shows up alive, I mean, dead whales often wash up ashore during a storm or something, because when whales die, they either sink to the bottom of the ocean or they drift ashore. But when whales strand alive, it's always a mystery, and that's why the National Marine Fisheries Service is in charge of investigating unexplained mortality events. So there are a range of reasons. It can be toxins. It can be an underwater explosion that if they're dynamiting underwater, which they had been known to do in these waters when they're dynamiting reefs to build resorts on the beaches. There can be sometimes they get disoriented and swim ashore, which is typical of pilot whales, which are known to, where they follow the leader of the pack, of the pod, and if the leader gets disoriented and swims ashore, they all do. But these animals were clearly traumatized because they were bleeding, some of them, from the eyes and the ears. They were so disoriented that they couldn't swim straight. But when they do end up on a beach or even in the shallows and are exposed to the air, they very quickly are at risk of dehydration and hypothermia. Their whole bodies are regulated to maintain their body temperature in the water. And once they get outside, the weight of their own body can crush their chest cavities, their rib cage. And once they've been stranded, once they've beached, it's very difficult for them to survive reentry into the water because of the trauma, despite everybody's, you know, good wishes and wanting to get out there and rescue whales. And Balcom knew this.
Yeah.
So that's why he knew there would be specimens the next day.
Well, that's what's so amazing about the story, I have to say. And in some ways, that the fact that he was there because you talk about the fact that a lot of the times when a whale beaches itself, you know, they just will sit there and rot or somebody will try to go bury it. But what Ken Balcom understood was, we need to go and dissect these animals. And so he started cutting off the heads of those who had died and doing these autopsies. And this is the really critical part of the story, because then he starts to understand what's really going on. Talk about this evidence trail. This is an important part of the story.
Well, the reason Ken Balcom knew that he knew that any whale that stays on the beach for more than a few hours, particularly in the tropics, is going to rot. It means the same thing happens to fish if you leave it out in the sun, and or any dead animal. And but he knew that it was particularly critical because there had been incidents previously of mass strandings of whales, particularly these species of beaked whales, in the presence of naval sonar exercises, particularly in the Canary Islands and in the Mediterranean. In Greece in 1996, there was an incident that was investigated, but the specimens that were recovered were not fresh enough to draw firm conclusions. There was strong circumstantial evidence, and there was evidence, but the Navy was able to say, well, the specimens were not in good enough shape. And by the way, the Navy had basically conducted these investigations because there's nobody, certainly in foreign waters, there's nobody else to do it. And this was in the Bahamas, which is a foreign country, though it did end up being investigated by the U.S. Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service. But in this case, Balcom knew that they needed to get them to collect the specimens as soon as they could, and so he called up Bob Gisner, who at the time was at ONR, and they agreed that the best thing to do would be to cut off the heads and get them into a deep freeze as soon as possible. And so he got up at dawn the next day and went out in a plane looking for carcasses on the beach, and his wife started combing the shore in a boat, and they each found one great specimen. And again, by the next day it was too late, except in these two circumstances. One, with the whale he found had been ravaged by sharks, so most of its trunk was gone, but it had the benefit of having exsanguinated, which means it had bled out. So all the blood had poured out of the body, which has the paradoxical effect of preserving the organs and tissue samples, because the blood is actually what part of what rots it so quickly. So that was a find. And then his wife found one that had appeared to have come inside a lagoon and stranded in a lagoon and had just died. So nobody had seen it the day before, and it had probably suffered in the lagoon overnight, but it clearly just died. You could see signs of that. So they had two very fresh specimens, and that became the evidence trail that indirectly led all the way to the Supreme Court, because it's the first time that there was a solid physical evidence trail that was subsequently examined. You know, the Navy sent down their ace whale pathologist, and Balcom and his wife ended up, you know the story, but taking them up to Harvard where they were scanned, and so that was the beginning.
What did the autopsies tell him about what had happened to the whales?
Well, there were two autopsies, well, actually multiple ones, but Darlene Ketton, who was really the go-to whale pathologist who worked in Woods Hole, but the Navy would contract with Woods Hole to send her down to investigate unexplained or mysterious strandings. She went down there and did what's a beachside necropsy. They took one of the heads out of the deep freeze and they took the ear bone out, and she was able to see right there that there was blood in and around the vessels and the structures of the ear bone. There's something called the bulla that protects the ear. But she already saw that there was a problem. And that was videotaped, by the way, because Balcom was the other interesting thing is that Balcom had made his career on what's called photo identification, which is this idea that you can actually identify whales by photographing their dorsal fins and the scarring on their backs. And people had scoffed at this idea originally, but he basically demonstrated that they all have unique scarring patterns on their bodies, and you can, in fact, individually identify them. So he was used to having video and audio and film equipment around. So as soon as they started doing this whole stranding event, the rescue, the recovery, Ketton coming down and doing a beachside necropsy, was all documented by him and his team. So that was also part of the evidence trail. And then when he took the heads up, she said, bring these heads up. There was a couple of weeks of paperwork they had to clear to get the heads out of the Bahamas and into the United States. But he and his wife literally carried these two whale heads packed in crates or in boxes with gaffer tape, carried them up on commercial airliner to Boston, and he sat in on and filmed and got copies of the scans of CT scanning, which they did in the middle of the night in this Harvard hearing lab where she had permission to do marine mammal work after hours. And what they saw was clear evidence that there was blood inside the brain, inside the ear canals, and that is consistent with acoustic trauma. And she really was the expert in this, so she was the right person to be investigating it.
So it's so cloak and dagger, isn't it? I mean, I guess that it really is a mystery in some way, the way this story plays out. I guess we should point that out. As I said, it's a mystery as much as it is an exploration of this marine science.
Well, part of the mystery is that there's so much we don't know about whales. This species of whales is what they call understudied or little studied because they're so hard to study because they're underwater so much of the time. And the mechanism of action of why, I mean, it's pretty clear why whales flee this, or there are certain obvious reasons why high-intensity sonar in a closed canyon space would drive marine mammals who are very sensitive acoustically. That's the thing you have to understand. These animals have, all whales, all marine life are very acoustically sensitive, but whales have evolved to hunt and navigate in this dark ocean environment. And the ocean, don't forget, is totally dark as soon as you get a couple hundred feet down. So any animals who live below the surface have to learn how to navigate in the dark. So they've become increasingly sensitive and sophisticated acoustically. So if you look at the brain of a whale, their acoustic centers of the cortex are much larger and more developed than our own. So it's not mysterious why acoustically sensitive animals would flee a very noisy environment, even as far as if it drives them onto beaches. However, the mechanism of action of what it is and how it actually kills them in terms of the trauma is still, is part of the mystery that's continuing to unravel.
I want to play a piece of tape before we go to break. Because you mentioned in the book that the Navy itself has these acoustic modeling that shows that sound from their sonar training, and we'll get to that as we go along, but it collects in this Great Canyon in the Bahamas in layers. The sound never really escapes. You call it an acoustic storm. There's really no escaping. I mean, this is what the whales are freaking out about. But I want to play this piece of tape and set this up for us, if you would, because to get a sense of really what the whales are feeling or hearing, I guess.
Okay, well, in this environment, you're playing a tape from Harrow Strait, which is also a closed environment. It's a strait where there's land on two sides. But in the Bahamas, it's the same sonar, though. It's called mid-frequency sonar, and it is audible to humans and, of course, to these whales. And in this environment, if you almost think of this canyon as a bathtub, a big old cast iron bathtub, if you can envision that, and it's, 100 miles long and 50 miles wide, but it's a closed space and it's very deep. But it does have very steep walls. So if you start pouring sound in, and this was, in this case, five battle group of three destroyers and two cruisers with various kinds of active sonar, some sweeping, some omnidirectional, some unidirectional, but you're dumping very high decibel sound into this environment. And unlike the open ocean, where it would eventually dissipate, and it does dissipate pretty quickly as you move away from the sound source. But in this case, the sound is bouncing off the sides of the canyon, off the bottom, off the top, and there's nowhere for the sound to attenuate, to dissipate. And so what you have is just this buildup of sound, and it does accumulate, as their modeling showed, at the surface, partially because that's the warmest layer of water, and also because the pressure is less up there and sound tends to go in that direction.
Well, let me play this, and then we can talk about what it's like for a whale, because you get a sense that it's pretty intense for them. Here's this clip of sound. So it's high pitched. Does it hurt? Does it hurt them?
Yeah. Well, I'm wearing headphones here, but it hurt my ears. I mean, I'm glad you played a full 10 seconds, because when I play that when I'm speaking in public and play a clip, I'm tempted to shut it off immediately because I see people are squirming in their seats because it's so unpleasant. And it's also hard to appreciate the volume at which it's playing underwater, because we're listening to it in the air. But, sound travels 5 times as fast in water. Sound behaves differently in the water. So it's 235 decibels at the source. Again, it does attenuate as it moves away from the source, but that's one of the loudest sounds in nature, a magnum of whatever the Clint Eastwood magnum is about 270 decibels. So it's been compared to a jet engine, going on, next to your ear. But again, that's a terrestrial analogy. So there are different theories. I mean, it's definitely, sound can be used as a weapon, and this is a kind of weaponized sound. It's not used as such, but it's classified as a weapon system by the Navy for good reason. Some animals use sound to stun their prey in the water because it can stun. It can absolutely it can damage all sorts of structures in your ears and your brain, but. One of the theories about why the whales do poorly or, die or have this acoustic trauma that's so disabling that can kill them is that typically this species of whale, because they dive so deep, they surface very slowly, the same way a human diver who has to do that. Otherwise, you get the bends, which is a very painful thing. We have nitrogen bubbles in your blood that can go to your brain. And so in any case, these whales, it's reasonable to suspect that these whales that can take up to 40 minutes to descend and another 20 minutes to ascend, or rather 20 to descend and slower, 40 minutes to ascend, would in a panic swim very quickly to the surface and get the bends. And there have been on subsequent strandings, because there have been one subsequent to the Bahamas that have also been well documented, they have found nitrogen bubbles in the blood and in the organs and the liver of whales. So it's fair to assume that's one of their panic responses, is they just flee to the surface much faster than they should and are used to doing. And so that's probably what happens. And if you can imagine, them diving a mile down and then surfacing through what is increasingly intense sound as you go towards the surface. So you have what's called a surface duct, where the sound amplifies. It's almost like how a Fresnel lens in a lighthouse would amplify light. That's the analogy that acousticians have given to me about what a surface duct does to sound. A warm, it's called the afternoon effect. As the sun warms the surface of the water, you have a much warmer surface layer, and the sound is much more intense. So these whales, when they're surfacing to breathe, which they still have to do once an hour, have to go through 500 feet of this most intense sound. Yeah. You can imagine why they'd want to swim away from this canyon.
Ken Balcom discovers a Navy destroyer in the area. He makes the connection. But just as we had to a break mention, as you do in the book, he's pretty reluctant about, as we said earlier, he's pretty conflicted here. He's a former Navy guy, and he went along. He had a security clearance. He was game to be secret about some of these sonar things. But when the Navy came to do the research here, they didn't want to go public with it, and Ken Balcom says he found that unacceptable, and he kind of breaks with the Navy here in this particular case.
Yeah, and it's if you read the book, anyone who reads the book will see it was a more subtle sort of dance where the Navy was inviting him to be part of this investigation and just not play along with us, but the Navy, you have to understand, has all the investigatory assets. They have the acousticians, the computers to model what happened in the canyon, the people like Darlene Kent, the pathologists, and they have the money to. And these are expensive investigations, and so. He was delighted as a scientist to be working with the Navy's best people to try to figure out what happened. His turning point became after he brought the heads up to Harvard and realized that they were stopped, no longer returning his calls, and that he had fulfilled his necessary function to him, that he was being shut out of the investigation. They were very likely to sweep this under, not share their findings with the public, is when he very reluctantly became a whistleblower, and he was reluctant because he had served for 7 years. Mm-hmm. He re-upped after his first term, and he was very loyal to the Navy to the point where his wife and research partner for 10 years never knew what he did with the Navy. I mean, he took his secrecy oath very, very seriously, and the Navy is famously the most, it's called the silent service because it's the most secretive of the services, and he honored that, you know, throughout his life. No one ever knew what he had done in the Navy. He told his wife he had been a Navy pilot, which is what he had trained as, and that was all she knew. So it was a very tough call for him, but, you know, that's why it's a great story, frankly. It's because he had a lot on the line. I mean, Joel Reynolds, the environmental attorney, invested 20 years of his career in this lawsuit, but it was a professional risk for him. For Ken Balcom, the stakes were a lot higher.
We'll talk a bit more about Joel Reynolds when we get back from a break. Joshua Horowitz is with us. His book is called War of the Whales, A True Story. And we'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science writer Joshua Horowitz is joining us. In his new book, he tells the story of the struggle between the American Navy and marine mammals. The book makes this connection between powerful naval sonar systems and the mass stranding of whales. His book, again, War of the Whales, A True Story. Well, let's talk about Joel Reynolds, another important character in the book. Grows up in Riverside, California. He's tenacious guy, good at, as you point out, exploiting his adversary's weakest points. He's a really good lawyer, pretty gutty kind of guy. How does he get connected with environmental stories, and in particular this one?
Well, I think his interest in the environment really just goes back to having grown up in California, spent a lot of time on the beach in the mountains, and you know, like a lot of Californians, held that very dear, and very early age got interested in conservation law. Interestingly, he had never done ocean law, marine mammals, anything like that before he sort of stumbled on this story. He had done endangered species protection on land and had done variations on the spotted owl defense of ancient forests. He would find, you know, a species that wasn't going to be endangered if a freeway got built through a wetland or things like that, and had been very successful. And he got involved in this originally around ship shock, which was a program where the Navy would set off 10,000-pound explosives in the marine sanctuary off of Santa Barbara to test the hull integrity of a battleship before it went out to sea. And he made, you know, he took the Navy to court and made the self-evident case that they could easily test the hull integrity by blowing up these, you know, making these big explosions farther out at sea where there's much less marine life to be threatened. And so when he won that case, which, you know, the Navy lost and settled on, people started to come with him with other things, including some underwater noise experiments the Navy was doing that came to light, and that led him to discover this low-frequency active sonar, which is this super sonar system, if you will, that was using very high-intensity, very low-frequency sound to detect, at the time it was developed 10 years earlier during the Cold War, to detect Soviet submarines beyond the horizon, hundreds of miles away. And this was in 1995, 5 years after the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Navy had long ago rusted at dock. So it was just one of these legacy systems the Navy was still developing and testing and was about to deploy. And so that was when he got involved. And, you know, what's remarkable about this story is that you have these two individuals without whom I'm convinced that this story would not have surfaced. It may have eventually. Mm-hmm. But when Joel Reynolds started investigating this and trying to rally the science community around this to get the scientists to start looking at this connection between sonar exercises and mass stranding of whales, he was sort of a voice in the wilderness. And he wasn't a lawyer. He wasn't a scientist. And yet he was determined to see this through. And with, you know, he did have Natural Resources Defense Council behind him, but he was really the the only person working on this for years. And it wasn't until the Bahamas that he's really built up a staff that was able to pursue this more aggressively.
Yeah, he's a non-scientist, but he must be as knowledgeable as scientists are about these whale strandings. He goes around doing this research. He's pretty well informed at this point, I'm guessing.
Well, he knew based on his terrestrial cases to protect endangered species that you need good expert witnesses. Yeah. If you're going to go to court, you have to have a good scientist. So he understood the value of good science and good scientists, and NRDC had always used scientists to support their legal cases. They had their own scientists. They used a lot of outside scientists. So... and the thing about Reynolds is he's not one of these lawyers. Sometimes you meet these super lawyers who are just in love with the law, or they love the fight, or they love something about it. They get to be aggressive in court, you know, sanctioned aggression. And he's not like that. He's atypical. He's really a strategist. He's a campaigner. So he'll settle a case if he thinks he can get half a loaf. He doesn't bring cases just to get publicity for suing somebody. He only brings cases he feels he can win and build a case law foundation. He uses celebrities if that can be useful. He uses direct mail. You know, he uses the members to NRDC members to bombard whoever the adversary is with petitions or letters or emails. He'll do whatever it takes. And so he's unusual. And to me, this is just a wonderful case history in what an agent of social change looks like. Both he and Balcom in totally different personalities and different skill sets, but they share, you know, this quality of perseverance and determination not to relinquish something. I mean, this is, you know, court cases take forever, not forever, but years and decades. And I think that's one of their shared hallmarks is their perseverance.
You run into an impasse here, of course, once the Navy does come out and acknowledge the connection. You know, the question becomes, are the deaths of these, you know, magnificent creatures, are they worth it in some ways for the sake of national security? And you deal with that question because the story isn't really about collateral damage during warfare. This is about training exercises.
Right. I mean, all of the lawsuits have been over training exercises. Nobody has ever disputed the need and right of the Navy to use sonar in combat situations. It's critical technology for them to detect enemy submarines that could sink a battleship or even an aircraft carrier with thousands of sailors aboard. So, you know, this is a necessary part of their arsenal. The problem is that you know, the ratio of training to combat is rather large. And so, and then the Navy contends that not only do they need to train, but they need to train in the environments where they're going to have to fight. So that sort of became the pivotal issue, because what the environmentalists have been arguing, and particularly NRDC, which has been leading this fight, is, you know, yes, train, but don't train in marine-rich environments, you know, marine mammal-rich in particular. And so either avoid those or avoid them seasonally. So you should have geographic and seasonal exclusions to where you can train. So the Navy has not been back to the Bahamas to train since this incident. And ironically, it was the first time they had trained there. They either didn't know or didn't care if there were whales there, but they haven't been back since. But there have been other strandings involving the U.S. Navy, and they have been in known whale habitats. So that's sort of been the crux of it. And, you know, I have to say that over the course of these decade-long, not one single lawsuit, a series of lawsuits and other actions and negotiations and settlement agreements, the Navy has come a huge way from total noncompliance. So, after the Cold War, when they didn't even in the 90s, when they didn't even acknowledge that they had to apply for permits like anyone else and have to do environmental impact studies and now they do environmental impact statements and studies on all of their domestic ranges off the U.S. coast. They unfortunately don't do that in the foreign ranges where they also train and occasionally have strandings. But they've come a long way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a matter of, you know, are they close enough to actually talk to each other rather than litigate and only do it in court? you know, I think that's my hope, is that they're close enough that they can actually close the gap through negotiation at this point.
You've got these sophisticated sonar systems from the Navy. That's an issue. But the other thing you bring up in the book, of course, is that there's a larger concern here about just noise pollution in the oceans in general. You've got international shipping, you've got oil and gas exploration. And this is as much a concern, I suppose, for you and others as naval training exercises.
Well, absolutely. There are two kinds of noise pollution in the ocean that are widely recognized by, you know, all marine biologists as a threat. And those are either acute or chronic. So sonar is an example of acute noise, you know, something, a battle group moving through an environment over the course of 10 hours. That's an acute source, and that has often lethal consequences. There's equally problematic non-lethal effects of noise in the ocean, including sonar, where animals are, there's so much noise in the ocean now, particularly from oil and gas and shipping, where there's just the noise level is doubled every 10 years going back 5 decades. And for obvious reasons, there's more and more underwater gas and oil extraction, there's more and more international shipping. But the net effect is that the bandwidth, the environment that these acoustically sensitive animals have to not just hunt and navigate, but find mates, to forage for food, all of their life-supporting activities are acoustic in nature. So if they can't communicate with each other, if they can't use their sonar, they are really threatened, not necessarily with beaching on the shoreline, but not being able to find mates is a quick way to become extinct or not be able to find your food. And many of these are endangered species.
There's another irony here. You mentioned that the Navy might actually be the best suited entity to really deal with this. I mean, they do a lot of research in these noise quieting technologies for ships and warfare. Maybe they could share some of that technology, you think?
Well, Doug, I'm really glad you brought that up, because this is sort of, you know, my book was published this summer, and I'm still speaking about the book and about the topic and all sorts of venues. But what I'm really focused on going forward is figuring out and really working, because I spent a lot of time talking to the Navy over the last 6 years that I spent on this book. And, you know, there are a lot of naval assets that could be brought to bear in solving or at least reducing the problem of noise in the ocean, because the Navy is the world leader, the U.S. Navy, in ship quieting and what's called ship noise isolation technology. They want their ships to be not only quiet for stealth reasons, so that they're hard to detect in the water, but they also want them to be quiet because it's less drag in the water and it uses less fuel, and they are one of the biggest oil and, you know, energy consumers in the world. So they want to reduce their energy bill. So a lot of this technology is still classified, some for good reasons, some not necessarily required. So I think there's a huge opportunity for the Navy to be a big part of the solution to the noise in the ocean problem. And there are a lot of people inside the Navy, I think, who see this and would like to seize this opportunity to be part of the solution. And that's what I'm focused on trying to facilitate and enable.
Do you think it's a, I think you've said somewhere that you're not sure it will be a technological solution as much as a common sense one, though?
Well, to the sonar problem, I think that, you know, there are some technological approaches to reducing the impact of sonar. One, I think, obvious one is to try to develop more simulation programs for trainings and have less live trainings. But you know, there's all this investigation of, well, is there a frequency that they could be tuned to that wouldn't hurt the whales? And I think that's somewhat tilting at windmills, because there's so many different species of whales and they all have different hearing bandwidths, and I think that's unlikely to be a solution. I think that if the Navy could sit down and negotiate across a table with either NRDC or any other party, Earth Justice is also suing them in court, but I think that there are, you know, solutions that would greatly reduce the risk to not just marine mammals, but all marine life, that would probably be compatible with the Navy's goals. And I just think, you know, neither technology, there, you know, I think the litigation has had an invaluable role up to now. Going forward, I think negotiation is probably the best way to get there.
You know, you reflect on a pretty brutal time in human history in terms of our relationship with whales. One in particular, the ruthless whale hunt in the winter of 1857. And I wanted to ask you about that. Basically, one particular whaling captain, a Charles Melville, I took note of that name, Scammon, basically empties the Baja Lagoons in California of whales in 1857. And I guess the question is, you put that in the book, you talk about that history. Are we learning the lessons? Are we reflecting back on those days?
Well, I mean, I included that story for a couple of reasons. One is that Joel Reynolds and NRDC were instrumental in saving the whales of that same lagoon, the survivors of that time from industrial development about 10 years ago. But also, it's reflected because Charles Scammon was a ruthless whaler, and ironically, he was also one of the most important naturalists. When he retired from whaling his middle age, he started writing natural history books about the natural behavior of whales based on his observations of whales over the decades, and it's one of the best records we have of the 19th century, of what whales were up to in the 19th century. He was also a guy who figured out that these whales return to the same lagoon they migrate all the way up to the Bering Sea along the California coastline, as all Californians know, and all the way back down each winter to these a couple of lagoons in the middle of the Baja Pacific coast, and they calve and they spend some time with their calves there, and then they head up to the Bering Sea again. And he heard about this, and he basically bottled up the mouth of the lagoon with his ship and went out in smaller boats and just butchered every whale in the lagoon, and butchered the mothers, and the children died, of course, because the calves couldn't live without their mothers. But one of the most ruthless exterminations, near exterminations. So they were considered, they were assumed that they were extinct for decades, and they quietly resurfaced eventually. But these are the Pacific gray whales. So in any case, I'd like to think that we're at a different stage. One of the good ironies of the story, the positive ironies of the story, is that the Navy, through decades of research, and they are still the major funder of marine mammal research and have been for 50 years, have taught us so much. Most of what we know about these animals is based on Navy research. And so we now understand them on a totally different level. We understand that they are highly intelligent, sentient mammals who we, you know, can communicate with, potentially can definitely commune with, that have great value to us beyond their commercial value as vats of floating oil, for which they had for a millennium, that we now see that they have a much greater value. And the good news is that whale watching has grown to become a huge industry worldwide. And the more people get out there on the water and actually see these animals in their natural environment, not at SeaWorld, not in aquariums, but out in the wild, the more public pressure there will be to preserve them. And that's, to me, the most hopeful part of this, the arc of this story, is that the more we know how precious and invaluable they are as part of the world ecosystem and how much they enrich our lives and can.
Joshua Horowitz, his book is called War of the Whales, A True Story. He joined us from member station WAMU in Washington. Joshua Horowitz, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.